The views expressed on The Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw Radio, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina 28816. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email if you end up using any content. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.
This week I speak with the wife of vegan, anarchist, anti-fascist political prisoner Eric King. Eric was convicted of attempting the September 11, 2014 firebombing of a Kansas City office of Missouri Democratic congressman in solidarity with the Ferguson uprising that kicked off after the killing of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. The office was attacked at roughly 3 a.m. when it was empty. Eric took a non-cooperating plea deal for 10 years in federal prison with no chance of parole. Recently, prison administrators at Florence and later Leavenworth Federal Prisons had been abusing, isolating, and moving Eric around, and his support crew have initiated a call-in campaign, which we mentioned last week. You can visit supporterickking.org for more details and keep up on what's happening, and see our show notes for a few articles on subjects spoken of in this episode, including Daniel McGowan's recent story published by the ACLU entitled What the Government Shutdown Really Means for Federal Prisoners. And be sure to check out the link at supporterickking.org to find out more about and how to participate in the call-in campaign that's ongoing. But before we hear from Eric King's partner, I'm happy to share audio from a recent episode of Bad News, Angry Voices from Around the World, the monthly podcast of the A Radio Network. This time, Cherna Luknia from Ljubljana, Slovenia, spoke with a member of A Radio Berlin who was traveling with a media caravan through Mapuche territory to cover news there and to offer media equipment and trainings to communities in Walmapu, in so-called Chile and so-called Argentina. You can find the full episode of Bad News at a-radio-network.org and by clicking the menu on the upper left. There you can also learn about the A Radio Network, participating projects, and how to get involved. And keep an ear out for the coming months for the live audio that they'll be producing in studio in some undisclosed place in Europe. How exciting when their conference comes to a close. And we are also a proud member of the Channel Zero network of anarchist podcasts. Here is a jingle from a member of that network.
Radical Underground is a podcast that connects underground music with radical politics from around the world. So if you like anarchy and good music about kicking fascists in the face, check us out on Channel Zero, SoundCloud, iTunes, and anywhere else you can find us. Sick of your right-wing bullshit, it's a fucking disgrace. So let the vegan persuading, kicking you in the face.
Transmission Prison Project would love for you to join them on January 24th for the 4th Annual International Day of Solidarity with Trans Prisoners to send letters and drawings of support, love, cheer, and solidarity to incarcerated trans folk and incarcerated folk with trans experiences and identities. They will provide cards, envelopes, stamps, and snacks. You could just bring your undying desire to end the prison industrial complex. That'll be happening at Firestorm Books and Coffee at 6 p.m. on Thursday, January 24th. A week later, on Friday, February 1st at 6 p.m. sharp. Blue Ridge ABC will be viewing Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is a two-hour documentary from 2013 about former Black Panther journalist, author, and activist Mumia Abu-Jamal, who many believe was framed up on charges of killing a cop in Philadelphia by the Philly PD in 1981. Mumia has always held to his innocence. In any case, innocent or guilty, the case betrays biases by the court and policing system that held a man on death row for nearly three decades, a man who has fought from within to document America's excesses and for the rights of oppressed peoples inside and outside of prison. After the movie, also starting at 8 p.m. at the Mothlight on Haywood Road in West Asheville, Witch Gang Coven presents a showcase of local hip-hop and beats featuring Witch Boy Exakuma, Scarla Ween, Cool World Order, Herb the Wizard, and Xor. The show is a benefit for Blue Ridge ABC, and more details can be found on pricing and such at brabc.blackblogs.org. Come visit the table, pick up some merch, do whatever.
You are listening to Cherna Lukna,
Black Hole,
anarchist radio show on Radio Student from Slovenia.
We will be joined by a correspondent from A Radio Berlin, who is currently in Chile, and will be joined Caravana Valmapu. He will brief us about the current situation on Mapuche territory and about the caravan.
Poklicali ste Črno luknjo in njeno kontrainformativno mrežo. Po pisku oddajte svoj glas.
So with us, we managed to get in the last minute also the comrade from Anarchist Radio Berlin, which is in Chile. So hello.
Hello. Hi.
What are you doing there?
Yeah. So it's not a surprise that I'm here because we have been invited to participate in a caravan, a media caravan, which. It's starting tomorrow, and it's happening here in the region, like a whole month. And we will be traveling the territory of the Mapuche, so-called Walmapu, which is partly in Argentina, partly in Chile. So our trip will be half in Argentina and half in Chile.
What is the aim of this journey?
Yeah, so as maybe some of you already know, because we talk about this topic regularly in the Bad News, the Mapuche are the biggest indigenous group in Chile, and they have been fighting for recuperating their lands. They have been occupied by the new states of Chile and Argentina some centuries ago. For a long time, and we are now visiting Mapuche communities on the way who invited us. So we will be talking to them, listening to what they have to say, listening to their stories of their struggles, but also as it will be a media caravan with people from free or alternative media projects from, I will tell later from where, we will also be giving workshops, so to enable the communities to communicate their stories themselves without us as intermediaries. So we'll be giving workshops on, let's say, how to operate a radio, how to do programs or whatever, and also try to give them some practical means, so equipment.
So we can expect to hear some more news from this region in the near future.
So definitely, you should check. You could check the Twitter from A Radio Berlin, @A_Radio_Berlin, or our blog, aradio.blogspot.de. There you will find news, but also on the web page of the caravan, which I don't remember now by heart, but you will find this information also on the blog of the Anarchist Radio Network. Yeah, it will be. It's something that is mostly organized by collectives from Latin America. So they have been doing this for years. They have a quite large network of free media. And this is like the third such event that they organize. The first was a caravan from Mexico to Honduras, that is in Middle America. And the second one was a coverage of the Olympic Games in Rio, not so long ago. And yeah, now the focus is to, yeah, amplify the voice of those Mapuche communities struggling. So people outside of Chile and Argentina get also to know, and we were invited also to help bring this information to Europe. So that's what we are planning to do.
Okay, definitely we will follow what you are doing and what is going on there. Is there something more you want to share with us?
Yeah, so the situation, especially from what I know in Chile, is very tense right now. In November, Mapuche Camilo Catrilanca has been killed. You might have heard also in the bad news about this case. He was killed from behind by a special unit from the police, the so-called Jungle Commando, which in the meantime has been dissolved because they lied repeatedly about what happened in this case. But in the end, two videos that showed exactly how this Mapuche was executed by the police disproved all the lies they were spreading. And so we will see what... what state and police are doing also in the region. Some hours ago, someone told me that the Minister of Interior, Chadwick, who has still not resigned over all this shit, seems to be have been in the Mapuche region some 2 or 3 days ago, which Mapuche communities, of course, saw as an as a provocation, because so what do you want? So after doing so much bullshit, okay. So that's what we will be also talking about in the near future. So from the 15th of January to the 15th of February. So stay tuned.
Okay, we will. And good luck, good luck, and good fight. And we will be in contact.
Perfect. Thank you.
We are in solidarity. Ciao.
Ciao.
We came to the end of this edition of Bad News, but before we sign off, we have an announcement to make.
Yes, next month we will have another gathering of anarchist and anti-authoritarian radios from around the world. This year we go to Switzerland. The gathering will be hosted by Infolora, one of the participating collectives in the Anarchist Radio Network. The gathering will be between 14th and 17th of February, and as every year, the final day, Sunday, the 17th of February, will be dedicated to special radio program that will be produced on the spot by the participants of the gathering.
Okay. That's it for now. See you on the streets.
So I'm joined by a supporter of vegan, anarchist, anti-fascist, political prisoner, Eric King. Could you please introduce yourself to the audience?
Hi, I am a member of Eric's support crew as well as Eric's wife.
I really appreciate you taking the time and energy to record this conversation with me on such a painful and hard topic that's so close to your heart. So thank you very much for taking this space.
Thanks for giving us the space to get this out.
Can you tell listeners about Eric? It's been a couple of years since we've had someone on the show to talk specifically about his case and about him.
Definitely. Eric is a vegan, anarchist, political prisoner. He was arrested in 2014 after an attempted firebombing of a state representative's office in Kansas City that was carried out in solidarity with the Ferguson uprising. He was involved in a lengthy pretrial fight. He was backed into a corner by his federal judge, who wouldn't allow him to fire his incompetent public defender. It was a giant mess. The judge told him the case was too high profile to allow him to change lawyers. This forced his hand. He had to choose between having a trial with a lawyer who admittedly didn't even look up the sentencing guidelines until a year and a half in when prompted by us, as well as refused to negotiate for Eric in any way. She kept reminding us what a straight shooter the state's attorney was and what a good guy he was. So either a trial with her or signing a plea deal. He ended up signing a 10-year non-cooperative plea deal that, I mean, the damage that was done in this situation ended up tolling up to a broken window. And throughout his entire pretrial and within prison, Eric has remained outspoken about the prison system, as well as writes pretty awesome poetry that you can check out on his blog.
Until recently, Eric has been held at FCI Florence, a federal facility in Colorado, right?
Yes, he has.
Generally, how did Eric's time at Florence go, and how did you as family relate to his being at that facility?
Initially, it was a mixture of very difficult and way better at the same time. His transfer there happened after a really turbulent situation where when he was at FBI Inglewood, I mean, we basically had a guard threaten our children. And when we decided to file grievances and file inspector general reports and whatnot, he was to give them a week that they would have an answer for him. And then on that day, they picked him up and drove him to Florence and brought him up on disciplinary charges of assaulting an officer because of a cartoon that he had drawn of a prison on fire. Also, they wrote his anti-government views. And so he was held in the SHU in segregation in Florence for about 105 days. So that was a long period that we didn't get to hear from him. It was very difficult communication. After that, it was a big relief for him to be brought into general population in Florence. It was a good degree further drive than Inglewood. Inglewood was about a half an hour round trip, and Florence is 4 hours round trip. But initially, the guards were actually pretty decent to us, and the kids really loved going and visiting, so it was nice having him in state.
So can you talk about the incident that occurred on August 17, 2018 at Florence?
So I received a phone call from a wife of another prisoner initially, and she was letting me know that they were going on lockdown, and she had had an email from her husband that very shortly stated that Eric went on a guard and that he was taken to segregation. And it was weeks before we knew what actually happened. When he was in Leavenworth, we were able to push to get him a legal call where we found out the entirety of the story. Eric, well, he was picked up off the floor and called in by an SIS officer, which is a special investigation services officer. They're the ones that handle security for the more dangerous prisoners, the way that they look at it. And so he was picked up by the SIS officer and Lieutenant Wilcox. They dragged him in a broom closet. He didn't want to go in there. There was no cameras. But they forced him in there. Wilcox started flipping out on him. It was a really weird situation. He attacked Eric. Four or five guards ended up running in. At that point, Eric put his hands over his head. He was dragged into the hallway where they beat him and told him that he just needs to die, that just threatening all of these vile things. They kicked him in the head and his ribs and his stomach. I saw a photo of him when I went to Leavenworth, and you couldn't even see his face. Like, one side was so swollen up. After that, they took him into a room that had a 4-point restraint bed. And those beds are, they hold each of the wrists down and each of the ankles down. And the way that he said it was like being crucified is what he said. They left him for 7 hours in that bed in his own blood, urine, definitely wouldn't let him get up. Nobody was coming in. He was just left there, like, scared after being beaten. He was then taken to another prison on the compound, a higher security prison, USP Florence. The weird thing about that is there generally has to be a hearing and approval before you're switched to a higher security prison, but it happened very hush hush. We have also, like, in the meantime, we were trying to get a hold of legal calls and nobody was responding to us. He was put in a cell and the cell had constant strobe lights overhead for the next 4 days. When he came into the cell, the toilet was clogged. It didn't flush. It was clogged with someone else's feces that was just sitting there. During his time there, medical attempted to visit him and they told medical that he was such a
mean... They as in the guard?
Yes, the guards. Sorry. That before he... medical came and the guards told medical that they weren't allowed to treat him and they weren't allowed to see him, that he was a really mean person and that they didn't need to mess with him. Eventually, he was taken into this interrogation room by SIS officers, where he asked to, again, make a phone call to his lawyer, and he was told that he was not going to be permitted to make a phone call to his lawyer unless he signed a deposition saying what had happened. And he made it clear that he was signing it under duress, but he really needed to just get done with this whole situation, so he ended up signing it before they sent him to Leavenworth.
So from Eric's expression of what happened with Lieutenant Wilcox in that broom closet, among other things, the agitated lieutenant ended up, the bad lieutenant, one might say, ended up screaming in Eric's face that Eric killed his daughters. Do you know what that's about? Is that a reference to anything that you or the support are aware of?
No, not at all. And even Eric isn't aware. It was a really weird situation. He was initially brought in there because Wilcox was angered by an email that Eric had sent, kind of laughing about a cop that had got hit earlier that day. And he lost it. Eric was saying that he was spitting and, like, making all these weird noises, just talking about erratic things. When he mentioned the daughter's thing, Eric actually tried to ask him, like, what's up here? Asked him if it was, like, anarchists that killed his daughters or something. And he doesn't have a clue. Eric is suspicious that maybe his daughters were in the military. We're not entirely sure. It was a very bizarre situation.
Does this Lieutenant Wilcox have, I mean, this sounds like a premeditated circumstance. If someone is getting another guard to bring a prisoner who's supposed to be, I mean, there's definitely no quibbling about the fact that the prison system in the U.S. is meant to punish people and not actually like solve any problems. But, you know, the people that are in charge of the prisons are supposed to promise some degree of protection of the individuals that are under their supervision while they're doing their sentence. Like, there's nothing in someone's sentencing that they get to get beat up by lieutenants. But so this sounds premeditative if he's moved away from cameras and then pounced on in this way, and then four guards know to run in to a broom closet. Does Lieutenant Wilcox have much of a history of erratic behavior or much of a name among the prisoners at Florence?
Definitely. I've spoken to Eric as well as some other people who were at Florence with him, and it was known that this was the dude to avoid, that he was a hothead, that he was known for flipping out on people. And as far as the broom closet, it's actually happened a few times that the security officers have gone to talk to him in there. So shady shit goes on all the time. It's one might think that you're supposed to be entitled to some degree of safety while you're there. But when Wilcox was getting ready to go down to business, he asked the security officer to leave so he could take care of the situation, is what he said. So it was definitely premeditated. It coincided as well as Eric, that at the end of the week, was going to be approved for a transfer that he had worked his way down to low security prison for the last year, and he was going to transfer somewhere safer, somewhere that he could just settle in. And coincidentally, this happened a week before that was approved.
It also happened right around another very pressing element in y'all's lives. Can you talk a little bit about, because you've been public about this already, but can you talk about the pressure that Eric was under and the pressure that you were under, and how your health relates to maybe the timing of these incidents?
Definitely. It felt like a purposeful attack. The day before, I had surgery to remove cancer, and this is something that is a really emotional thing for Eric. We had our last visit right beforehand, the last Sunday, and it was a very somber, just sad, like, we just wanted to have moments to love each other and spend some time together, because even though he's super supportive of me, it's terrifying to him. And while I was in the hospital the day before, I was able to talk to him. And then I ended up having to stay overnight. And I had just got home from the hospital when I got that call. It was horrible. I was so sick and I felt so bad. And then I just didn't understand what was happening, because that's not a situation that would have ever played out. And so this person's calling me trying to tell me, and I'm just like not understanding what's going on, because the timing was just ridiculous. And I mean, they all listened to our phone calls. Lieutenants and guards would often strike up conversations with him about my health issues, asking him how I'm doing, what's going on. And they knew that I was having the surgery. The phone call went through the chaplain's office. It was definitely well known.
Where is Eric now and what are his conditions?
He is being held in segregation at USP Leavenworth right now. After all the pressing that we were doing of the warden when he was being held in Florence, they decided to put him in a van and drive him to Leavenworth. Leavenworth really doesn't know what to do with him. He's been there for 152 days now. He's in complete isolation. He is not even technically under the jurisdiction of USP Leavenworth. So this allows the warden at Florence to continue to make decisions for him, one of which is, we found out when I drove all the way out to Kansas from Colorado that the warden had taken away visitation privileges. In the meantime, there wasn't any sort of hearing or anything like that. She had just decided that he wasn't going to be allowed to visit. He gets about one phone call a month, which we look forward to all month. It's difficult because we have to get a lot of business done in that phone call. Normally, he's got to tell me what's going on. He has to give updates. He was held for the entirety of this time without any disciplinary write-ups. He was not given any charges. He was told that the FBI was investigating. We recently found out that the FBI refused to pick up the investigation. The FBI cited officer wrongdoing. They didn't want any part in it. And then at that point, Eric was given a disciplinary shot for assault on an officer, the lowest level of assault that can be given, which is a really weird situation because prisoners in their disciplinary hearing, it's not court. They don't get to bring in evidence to argue. I mean, they're absolutely welcome to, but so the court system is supposed to entitle us to a certain degree of like justice. We have to be proven a certain way. The disciplinary hearings are the opposite of that. It's them that bring him up on the charges and it's them that decide they're guilty. So prisoners, when they're brought to disciplinary hearings, they know that they don't stand a chance. They're not going to be able to argue. It's pretty much what the prison says. And in this situation, it's really suspect that even in their own court, even in their own system, they can't even bring him up on disciplinary charges any higher than that. It's a really shady situation. He still hasn't had his disciplinary hearing. He keeps getting told that it will be next week, and it hasn't happened yet at this point.
So if the FBI has recognized that there was officer mishandling of the situation, but they refused to do anything about it, just thinking about like institutional approaches to getting something to happen in this case, is anyone thinking of applying pressure on the Department of Justice, or is that just considered a dead end and it's just about him taking the hit and doing the time?
Yeah. There's not really a ton that you can do as far as all of that. So they're going to get their pound of flesh no matter what. They had their hopes set on this FBI case. They told him constantly that he was going to get more charges, that he was going to be kept away from his family, that he was going to be in prison for longer amounts of time, and it just didn't happen. And when it didn't happen along the same time, they decided to let him know that they were pursuing sending him to the CMU, which is a notoriously shitty place. It's called the Communication Management Unit. They send people there who they deem risks to institutions or people via their communication with the outside. And there's a history of political prisoners being sent there. He was told the program is supposed to have a clear in and out. You go in, you work the program, you get sent out. But he was told that he wouldn't see another yard for the rest of his time. Visits will be behind glass. Phone time will. In federal prison, you get 300 minutes a month, which isn't a lot. It might sound like it, but he will receive even less phone time. And I mean, it's just this shitty thing. You can try to fight CMU placement all you want, but I mean, you're going to go there. Once you get there, you can continue to try to fight. But when you're up against the BOP, there's no choice but to continue to try to fight. There's no choice but to try to bring civil suits. There's no choice but to keep plugging away. But it's a pretty hopeless situation. I know we've sent Inspector General complaints in as far as misconduct, as far as the assault, as far as a situation that's going on with our phones right now. I don't really expect to hear back from the DOJ or the Inspector General's office.
Yeah, so you said that you are not allowed to visit and that they said that they told him that this was the case and he never heard such a thing and you never heard such a thing. Are you also blocked from phone calls then, from communication, you and your family with him?
Yes. They didn't tell him we couldn't visit. They finally added me to the visitation list after we fought to make it happen. And they even printed out him a copy of the visitation list to show him that, yes, we could indeed visit. And I got out there and was turned away at the prison and was told that he wasn't allowed visits, which the same thing happened when he got transferred to Florence. So it wasn't as much of a surprise. But what came as a big surprise is when he was getting ready to make his December phone call, which he was able to get the phone on the first of the month because, I mean, we both wait for this moment all month long. And he dialed my number and was told that my phone number was restricted, that he wasn't able to communicate with me. And he dialed it over and over to see if it was a mistake. And it kept saying the same thing. And so he frantically began to dial other numbers that he knew to see if they had just removed phone privileges. And he was able to get through to his mom, who was able to text me and send me messages to let me know what was going on. It was shocking. It wasn't. So the same thing happened in Florence to a certain degree. I got approved for the visitation list. Somebody went in and thought it was funny to take my name off of the list. And so it was just some random person doing some random thing. We knew that spouses communication, there's a very strict procedure they have to follow to limit spouses communication. And we both knew that there was no reason why our phone calls should be blocked. So it felt like just another situation where, oh, somebody's trying to get something over on us. November came and my number was still restricted and it started to get serious back when the number he first wasn't able to get through in December. He filed a grievance trying to find information out as to why my phone number was restricted, and nobody knew anything at Leavenworth. Nobody could give him any information. Since then, they have lost two of his grievances on that. They say, no, you must not have turned them in. We don't know. They must have got lost.
Cute.
You can turn them in again. And he's just not getting any answers. He's asking everybody and nobody knows. And like the lieutenant, the captain, nobody he asks has any idea about why we are not allowed to communicate. Although we found out yesterday that it was very purposefully done, but we still don't know why.
So over this last weekend, support for Eric put out a statement about his communications being limited and restricted and about the possibility that he was going on to hunger strike. Can you talk a little bit about this and flesh it out?
Definitely. Our letters going back and forth between Kansas can be a little held back by the prison. They can be delayed for whatever reason. It wasn't until Friday when we were getting ready to launch the call-in campaign for him that I got a letter saying that he was starting a hunger strike on Friday, that he just couldn't handle it. Nobody was giving him answers. And so it worked out nicely that we were able to be able to call in and be able to already have something drafted to get people to call in. So we launched the call in hoping that on Monday people could begin to call in. He began his hunger strike on Friday, and we got something sent back from the prison via email that said that Eric was notified on November 20th that communication with me was going to be cut off. And I mean, they even went as far as to say at 12 p.m. on November 20th, he was informed that communication was going to be cut off, that he was informed as to why communication was going to be cut off. And that was it. And this was the first time, though, that Leavenworth admitted that they had anything to do with it. However, later in the day, I actually was able to get a phone call from Eric. And this phone call was a part of a negotiation by the staff, not the upper level staff, lieutenant, that was able to negotiate that if Eric would eat dinner last night — it was day four of his hunger strike at that point — if Eric would eat dinner last night, that he would let him call me for a short amount of time. And it wasn't on his phone account because that was suspended. Eric called and told me about the hunger strike because he wasn't sure if I had got news of it. And we talked about it for a minute, and he let me know that he was calling me for this reason, and that nobody knows anything there. And like, I stopped him at that point because I informed him, no, people do know. The executive assistant actually very matter-of-factly told us that not only do they know, but you were told and that you should know. And he was floored, as was the lieutenant that was in the office that has been tasked with handling him and getting the hunger strike to stop. So whatever is going on right now that they don't want to tell us, as far as, and I have my suspicions, I am positive that proper procedure wasn't followed, that my number was just placed on a restricted list for no reason that they can prove, but that will all be flushed out eventually. So I'm on the phone with Eric, and at the same time, the lieutenant hears that the executive assistant, and I'm assuming the warden as well, since this is the warden's assistant, does know something's going on. He's starting to look around to see. I can hear him shuffling through papers, giving Eric information. The lieutenant confirms that there's a process, that it's not just taking somebody's name and putting it on a restricted call list. And at this point, it's going to give something, or Eric something. Up until this point, it's just been blame the other person. I don't know. It was probably Florence that did this. Who knows? It was probably a high up in the U.S. or in the BOP. It was the warden at Florence. It was a lieutenant at Florence. It was all these other people who have stopped communication with me. However, when we got that confirmation, it was a good thing that we were able to talk that day, because now Eric knows that it's actually Leavenworth, and he's able to continue to focus his efforts. His hunger strike is not over. He suspended it for a night because the whole goal was for us to be able to communicate. And so he was definitely going to take that when was offered, but he made it very clear that he's not going to stop, that he's continuing to search for answers, that he needs us more than ever to be calling in Leavenworth, calling in the regional offices, pushing back when they will try to tell people on the phone that Eric knows what's going on, that it's being handled, because we were able to get a phone call from him. We do know, in fact, with no mail delay whatsoever, that it is not being handled. And for some reason, I don't know if they believe they can only tell him once, but they're insisting with one breath that they tell, that they already told him, with the other breath telling him that he doesn't get to know. It's just the most ridiculous thing that we could fathom right now.
Hunger strike is back on. Eric is vegan. So already being in prison, his access to nutritious food and supplements is very limited. Can you talk about what being on hunger strike while you're vegan in prison means?
Already, Eric definitely has damage that was done to his body when he was in CCA Leavenworth. They refused to give him vegan food for the first 6 months. He was getting a spoonful of beans. God, I've memorized this. He was getting 2 spoonfuls of beans a day. He was getting 1 veggie a day, and he would get fruit once a week. And his body was shutting down. It was horrible. We were able to pressure the prison to give him food, which was one of the first vegan wins for him. It was awesome. When he got to the federal, his first federal prison, which was in Inglewood, he realized that you actually get a vegan tray there, which was exciting to him at first, but it comes with some drawbacks. The BOP has this non-flesh policy for the meals. They call it that. It's disgusting. But they're only guaranteed to 1 meal a day that fits into that, and that's no meat. So often his options include dairy. He can't eat that. Whenever the facility locks down or there is something going on, they will hand out sandwiches. And he's told over and over, his bologna sandwich, that the vegan option is to take the meat off the bread. one of the most difficult parts right now is when you're in segregation, you have limited access to commissary. And when these disciplinary charges come through, with whatever happens, it's very likely he's going to be on even further commissary restrictions. So he won't be able to purchase food for himself. And because up until this point, food has been either hit or miss, either you have it or you don't, his body is already exhausted from all of this. And so not having food right now, after not having access to good vegan food already that meets all of the nutrition requirements that we have, not having access to the vitamins to supplement that, B12, which is completely necessary for vegans. It doesn't feel good to know what he's going through right now, what he made it through in those 4 days, and what's happening today and what's going to happen tomorrow, and not knowing how long this will carry out. Because yes, there was wrongdoing. It's going to be easy to show that there was wrongdoing in the blocking of our communication. But at the same time, just because you can prove that something's wrong doesn't mean they're going to fix it. And so we're worried about our friend right now. Like, we worry about him as a family. Like, we worry because we know how strong he is, and we know how he'll keep going on this. This isn't an option for them to take away our communication. It's not something that he's willing to do. So hopefully we can get this handled. Hopefully we can do it before it starts to damage his body long term.
I think this is a really good opportunity to talk about your decision, y'all's support committee's decision to take a public stand in requesting for call-ins and raising awareness about what Eric's been going through, because there must have been like a fear that this would bring direct retaliation. He's in such a controlled situation already where petty power mongers get to inflict punishment on him. And the most he can do is be noble and be strong through it. And the most that folks on the outside can do is apply pressure and support him. Can you talk about why y'all have decided this risky line, and how folks who are on the outside can support him?
Definitely. As far as the hunger strike itself, that was all Eric and us following Eric's lead on that. He decided, for a minute there, it was looking like we didn't know what was going on. We weren't sure if this was just a funny joke that they were playing or what the seriousness was, since nobody would respond to him. And every attempt made to handle this within their system was made. Grievances were filed, phone calls were made, emails were sent out. There was just it was crickets. Not one answer was given. It wasn't even admitted that the phone number was blocked. It was told that it must be a mistake to him. And it was ridiculous, but it hit us real hard when January started and he still couldn't call me. And this disciplinary hearing was coming up, and we knew he was going to lose phone for even longer. And if we couldn't handle this now, if he gets transferred to another prison while this restriction's in place, it's going to take even longer to figure out and root it out and figure out why this happened and what we can do. So it was no choice. Eric and I have said over and over, if something happens and we can't communicate, we can't talk to each other, it's urgent. This is the only thing that's keeping him going right now, is to be able to talk to me. And at the end of that month, before we get another phone call, him and I are both losing it by that point. And just 15 minutes on the phone, like, helps reset us and helps us get back to our baseline. And this idea of this potential future in front of us, where we don't even get that, And we don't know if they've restricted visits from me also. They can't take away his written mail, so that's not happening. But we don't know if he gets transferred and I'm going to show up and we also can't visit. It's just such a huge thing, and it's just so important. He doesn't get to talk to anybody all month long, and it starts to fuck with your head at that point. And I mean, that has to be the point of why this is an effective form of punishment. And so it's not a coincidence at all, but it became very clear that we had to do something to fix this situation, and it was a very important situation. And so calling into the prison seemed like the best course of action. At this point, we didn't know if it was Florence. We didn't know if it was the regional offices. We didn't know if it was Leavenworth. So we've broken up our efforts to call into all three of those places right now and just be as obnoxious and persistent as possible, because they have to decide what is more of a pain in the ass to keep him in the dark about why this restriction has happened, and even to continue the restriction, or field phone calls just constantly tying up their lines. I mean, that's the choice, that's what they're going to have to do until they want to break from this.
So President Trump has decided to support Eric's case by further amplifying the pressure. I'm just kidding. Sorry.
Exactly.
But this is an interesting time where, because of the government shutdown currently going on, I mean, that the implications of the federal government refusing to pay contractors and refusing to pay employees, furloughing employees, has led to massive delays and call-in and threats of strike by TSA, by Transportation Security Administration workers who live paycheck to paycheck, as working people in this country do. The same thing, like a lot of the same pressures are passed down to people who are getting assistance in housing cost, in medical, in food access, all sorts of things, transportation. And another element of this is the federal prison system. While the federal prison system houses a very small proportion of the prisoners in the United States, folks in the federal, in the BOP, and folks who are held on immigration charges have to suffer the limitations. Now, I'm sure that neither of us are going to be calling for more funding and more money and support going to the prison system that's torturing people on a regular basis. But can you talk a little bit about what the implications on not just Eric in this instance, but on the prisoners are when the government shuts down in this way, when people's lives are being, you know, played chess with?
Definitely. You're taking a situation to start with where you have a bunch of cowboys, basically, and they are tasked and given weapons with keeping an order and taking care of prisoners. They already constantly sweat prisoners. They will yell at them and force people to respond. They will give them shots for nothing. It's just a constant thing. People are getting attacked by guards all of the time. It happens. The Eric's situation is not unique. His situation isn't unique in any way. It wasn't unique in Inglewood when it was for a cartoon and wasn't even for a physical alteration, and it wasn't unique this time. But you're taking these people who already are like that and not paying them. And, I mean, there's lawsuits left and right regarding different prison systems and sexual assault, abuse, people being killed by guards, and you're just amplifying it. And already in the past, so there has been budget cuts for a while since Trump came into office. And part of that budget cut was a hiring freeze. And we saw that play out in a very negative way. Eric shared his experience with this didn't get him a lot of love at the prison, but it was about the medical situations in Florence. And he talked about this horrible person and nurse who was now doubling as a guard. And so this nurse, who's supposed to be someone looking out for the health and well-being of prisoners, is now stopping and searching and put in this power position where abuse just is the natural course of action. And she even, I think she said it best herself, that she's a guard first and a nurse second. And that's what is having to happen as people are considered non-essential, or as people decide that I'm not going to wait for the shutdown to be over and like keep this BOP job and quit. They can't hire anybody else. So what's happening is not only are programs being shut down. I mean, I just read a good piece that Daniel McGowan wrote about the realities of what this shutdown means for federal prisoners. And it was a pretty awesome piece. He hit on a lot of that, but the medical, or the situation where people who are counselors or people who are mental health professionals or medical professionals are now being guarded, and it puts in danger not only that person's health, but it also, I mean, future treatment. Could you imagine? I mean, they've shown psychologically when people are in power, it starts to fuck with their heads and how they handle the people under them. So now it's these nurses and these mental health people who are tasked to take care and be the bad guys, be the guards for these people. Now what happens when everything goes back to normal and they see that same person in that office and maybe that person copped an attitude with them? I mean, they're going to get even shittier medical care at that point. In Daniel's article, he talked about reports of visits being canceled, people's holiday visits being canceled, programs being cut. It, from everything to the amount of pencils that are in the visiting room, to staff, to enrichment programs, to having enough guards on duty for religious services, it's affecting so many of the people in prison in such a bad way. And it's a scary situation. It's nerve-wracking for folks on the outside, let alone someone who is fully subject to the worst kind of people.
One thing I appreciate about Eric's communication is that he makes a point of also expressing that it, like, his situation is not unique in all these ways, that the negative things that are put upon him are negative things that are put upon a lot of other people. But because of Eric's communities, he gets to have more attention on it. Yeah. And he's a very special person.
He is. He gets people watching. This is, I mean, for the last couple years in the BOP, he's gone through a lot of this thought process, seeing people that he really cares about and seeing the things that happened to them. And one of the first things he had to check when he came inside was that white male anarchist ego really coming into it, thinking that he's going to come in there and he's going to help with things and he's going to like teach people things and he's going to do all of that. And he's realizing coming in that any of those thoughts that he would be having, that he's any different than anyone in there, is just perpetuating the system. That's just being the same as them at that point, when in the reality is he's not different than anyone in there. Retaliation happens to people who aren't political prisoners. It happens all of the time. And their families don't necessarily know how to handle it. They don't know the phone numbers to call. They don't know exactly how to deal with people. They don't know there's recourse. Often prisoners in there don't file grievances because they're afraid to even grieve something, to be ripped away from their family and moved across the country, to be attacked, to become an enemy of the guards. And it's even thought of in there as filing a grievance, which is something that almost all political prisoners I know can do it with their eyes shut because they constantly do it. Well, at least I know he does. And even that basic thing that's supposed to be the rights that are granted to him as a prisoner, they're afraid to do. So yes, Eric's different in certain ways. He's different because he has a community supporting him. He's different because he made a choice to go out like this path when there's a lot of people in there who didn't make a choice to be subject to class war, didn't make a choice to be subject to ridiculous racial criminal policies that, I mean, looking at the new Jim Crow, like it's just an extension of slavery. He put this hat on and was able to make that choice to put that hat on. And so he's different to where he's able to speak up against it. He's different because he has a badass community that backs him 100%. Mail comes in. He gets books sent to him constantly. He has people who are willing to ring the phone line over and over and over. And even some people who take pleasure in doing that. It can be a fun thing to call into prisons and just make their lives hell and tie their phone lines up. So yes, he is different in a couple ways, but it's hard because we talk about dismantling the prison system. We talk about prison abolition, but then we also want to care more about the people who came from our communities. And we want to care more about our friends being attacked, which nobody likes to see their friends attacked. But at the same time, this is prison. This is what prison is. This is what prison does to everybody. We're just not watching it. So we can't talk about prison without admitting that this is what prison is. It's not a surprise. It's not a shock. It's not anything that any family member of any prisoner would be surprised to hear about.
Well, friend, where can folks keep up on Eric's case and learn more about how they can help make those phone calls and write to Eric?
Yes, please. Checking out his support site is going to be the best thing to do, and that is supporericking.org. I'm sure you're going to provide a nice handy link when this gets posted, but we have the call-in script up there. We have the information and updates as far as what's going on. I know that there are things that Eric is continuing to write as far as sharing this process and what's happening with folks, and those will all go up on that site. And when we need help, we will definitely post it on there.
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw Radio, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email if you end up using any content. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.